From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, this is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Marlon Brando is the subject of a new biography, the first since the actor's death in 2004. The author is Stefan Kanfer, who's also written about Groucho Marx. The new book is called Somebody, The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando. Stefan Kanfer, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure to be here.
You know, both Groucho Marx and Marlon Brando, I guess, were the best in their fields. I mean, everything Groucho said was funny, you know, because Groucho said it. And Brando, I guess, is considered the finest actor in the history of movies by some. And yet, both of these men were discontented with their achievements. Groucho wanted to be taken seriously as a writer. He wanted a radio career. He wanted all the things he didn't have. And Brando, as you point out in the opening of your book, didn't value his talent or didn't believe that he had any special abilities. What's your theory on these two men?
They're somewhat separate. I think that almost all comedians are miserable. That's what sort of drives them on. They pick up objects or they look at things from the wrong angle or they pick it up from the wrong handle. And that's what helps them because they're usually bullied in school. They're either too small or they look funny or they don't get the girl. And so they compensate by being humorous. Groucho had a difficult beginning, but his parents were loving. I think for Marlon, it was a different kind of psychological setup. He was the child of alcoholics, a very brutal father, and a mother who was originally something of an artist and a good actress, but who succumbed early to booze and remained on it for a long, long time. I think Marlon felt no self-worth at all because his father said he wouldn't amount to anything, whereas Groucho's mother drove him on saying, I'm going to invent you and your brothers and make you something so you won't be street kids. So the only thing I think that unites them is misery.
And I guess the real tragedy of Brando is that he made about, I don't know, 30, 35 films or something, and only about 8 good ones.
Well, you know, my thesis is in the book, and I think pretty well proven in those pages, is that he was mentally ill most of his life, and the miracle is not that he made so many lousy movies, which granted he did, but that he made so many signal ones, important films that have really changed the history of cinematic acting. I mean, you could say that there's movie acting before Brando and after Brando, and you can see the difference, just as you can see the difference between painting before Picasso and after Picasso, and you can hear the songs before Sinatra and after Sinatra. You don't have to like Sinatra, but he changed the way people address music and lyrics. And I think Marlon changed the way people look at their parts and act them out. One of my favorite actors of all time, is, and many other people would agree with me, is Spencer Tracy. Wonderful actor, but he's protecting himself, like many another actor, Jimmy Stewart and others, protect themselves. Marlon went out there naked, and I think you couldn't have a performance by De Niro or Pacino. A performance like Raging Bull would have absolutely been impossible without Marlon's performance in, say, On the Waterfront. Just couldn't happen.
Then when you say he was mentally ill, what was the nature of his illness?
Well, I think there are two things. First of all, I think, you know, you're mentally ill, There must be some genetic component or chemical component that I'm not wise enough to analyze, but I know that his father was so terrible in squashing him. He had two sisters, one of whom became an actress, but then an alcoholic, and sort of drank her way out of the business. And early on, Marlon was convinced that he was worthless and never, ever really got over it. And then the fact that he had to drag his mother out of bars when he was 14 years old, she was almost semi-conscious, and he'd bring her home, and all of the humiliation that would obviously imply, and then his defiance of his father, which meant that any authority figure had to be shoved around, which meant that, of course, when he was sent to military school, he couldn't possibly deal with that, and I think that increased the mental illness and increased the sense of worthlessness, so that by the time he became a professional, he was fighting the authority figures, which were usually the directors of his films or the producers of his films. So it did not make for a very happy camp where he was.
Now, he made his, I guess his big impact, his first impact in this play called Truckline Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it like? What would we have seen if we were in the audience of Truckline Cafe?
The interesting thing about it was he played a war veteran who kills his girlfriend. But the interesting thing was not that. It was that Kazan was at that point not a director. Edie Kazan was a producer. Harold Klerman was the director, but Kazan noticed something, and that is Klerman had to move everybody around because this kid, who was 23 years old, was so magic. He had such animal magnetism that he was the only person anyone watched. So that when Kazan came around to direct Tennessee Williams in Streetcar, he said, you know, I know this kid's too young. He's 24, and Tennessee has written Stanley Kowalski for a man in his late 30s, but let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens. So Kazan sent Marlon up to Tennessee's hideout, which was in Cape Cod, and of course Marlon took his sweet time getting there and picked up a girl along the way. But by the time he got there, the electricity had gone out, and the toilet was blocked, and nobody knew what to do about the fuse. And Marlon, because he was frequently at home when his father was on the road and mother was so helpless, knew how to fix fuses, knew how to fix a blocked toilet. So right away he was in Tennessee's good graces. And then when he read for him, I think Williams realized, I'm in the presence of somebody who's a star. He isn't yet, but he will be. And by the time they hired him, it was pretty obvious that this play, Streetcar, was about Stanley Kowalski. It originally wasn't about Stanley Kowalski. It was about Blanche DuBois and her self-deceptions, but Marlon was just a star. He had that magnetism, which I define as somebody who, when there's five people on the stage, you watch him. You know, there are people that I don't particularly like Barbara Streisand, but when she's on stage, she's the one you watch, even if there are 15 people on stage. And Marlon was like that.
Well, was that a service to the story? I mean, he really sort of changed the nature of the play then.
It did, and you could argue that that he really, in some ways, tilted it the wrong way, which was somewhat restored in the film version, because there you would be able to move the camera around in a different manner. At the same time, it put Tennessee Williams on the map in a different way. It was a Broadway sensation. He's this 24-year-old kid who's the king of New York, but Tennessee Williams got taken along in the slipstream and went on to do other works of greatness, so I don't think you could say that Marlon in any way damaged him, but there's no question that it was changed because of him. And as a matter of fact, Jessica Tandy, who played Blanche DuBois in the Broadway version, said that Marlon was an impossible psychopathic bastard. Couldn't stand him. At the same time, she knew that he was a genius and that he was going to, in one way or another, influence her performance for the better, which he did.
Oh, we're talking with Stefan Canfer, and his book is called Somebody, The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando. So Brando did Streetcar on Broadway for a year and a half or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did he do that every single day?
Well, it's an interesting question because he didn't do it every single day. What happened was he would change from day to day. Sometimes he was bored, then he gave a boring performance. Sometimes he was electric, then he gave an electric performance. He was different each time, and he was very, very easily bored, so that it was really the last time he appeared in the theater. He just couldn't stand the idea of performing, 6 days a week and matinees on Saturday and Wednesday. It was very difficult for him, and I think what happened in the course of the presentation was that he realized there was no way that he could continue to be an actor on stage, and fortunately for him, the movie offers came in left and right. He was very cautious at the beginning because he didn't know whether he'd make it in films. And the first film he did was called The Men, which is not shown very much, which he played a paraplegic. But he preferred to do film after a while because he just felt, at least with film, maybe boring to do an original scene over and over and over again, but it's not like doing the same thing night after night after night.
Did you talk to him? I'm sorry. Did you talk to people in your research who had seen Brando in Streetcar more than one time over?
Oh, yes. Elaine Stritch was in his acting class. Stella Adler was his acting teacher, and she was really probably the greatest teacher of that generation, and she realized what she had and Elaine Stritch, who is, I think, one of the great cabaret artists of our time of any time, and, you know, sort of owns a lot of Sondheim songs, like I'm Still Here and The Ladies Who Lunch, told me that she'd seen him a number of times, and her feeling was that even sending Marlon Brando to acting school was like sending a tiger to jungle school. It was just, it was like watching a tiger on stage. Of course the tiger isn't going to give you the same performance night after night. Tiger is one of those magnetic animals who's going to respond to whatever the stimulus is. If the audience is up, or the audience is hostile, or the other actors are different, he'll be different. And so there was always that feeling with Marlon that he almost made it up as he went along, which in fact was the key to his success and also his failure.
Well, you mentioned in your book that, and we just talked about it, that he and Jessica Tandy didn't exactly sync up on the Broadway stage. And then in your book, you're kind of unfair to one of my favorites, Teresa Wright, who is his co-star in The Men. Well, I don't know if you were unfair, but you're unflattering about her performance in the film. Do you think he had a problem with actresses?
Oh, yes, I think he had a problem with all women. As is well known, he had three wives, none of which worked out, and innumerable affairs. I think not to be too Freudian about it, but it obviously devolves on the relationship he had with his mother, Dodie, and even though he named his independent film company Pennybaker, which was her maiden name, I think he had a very, very difficult time. I think the reason that he didn't jibe very well with Teresa Wright is that she came from a tradition in which you memorize your lines and you act a certain kind of way, rather formally. And Marlon liked to wing it, and that was true in almost anything he did. He believed that, when he wasn't being lazy, he believed that, we, as I'm doing now and you're doing now, we don't make up our lines and read them as we have rehearsed them. Somehow we just find each other through words. And so what he tried to do is sort of memorize a scene, but then throw away the lines and try to feel his way through, and that's why I think On the Waterfront is as great as it is, because there are a couple of scenes in there in which he clearly ad-libs his way out of it. One is when Edie Doyle, Eva Marie Saint, drops her glove, and she was never meant to drop her glove, but she did, and they kept the cameras going, and he puts the glove on, this little white woolen glove on his hand, and talks to her, and then takes it off and gives it back to her. It's a very sexy scene, but it's all done kind of euphemistically. And the other scene is the famous one in the back of the taxi. That could be the contender. That's a scene that he entirely winged. It wasn't written. It was written in formal manner, but then he just took a line or two of it and made us feel his pain.
And you took the title of your book from that scene, right?
Yes, I did, because I felt that, you know, he was a somebody, and he gave a lot of other actors. John Saxon talks about this, how he sort of empowered other actors, because you didn't have to be Tyrone Power anymore, or Robert Taylor. You didn't have to be good-looking, although Marlon was beautiful in his early years, later on not so much, but you could be a character lead, and that was very important.
Did Brando create the scene in the garden with Michael Corleone in Godfather? Was that one of his?
Yes, if you mean the death scene, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of scenes that he does. They wrote certain lines, but when he says them, you know, he'll grab a rose, or he'll get up and then lean to the side and say, "I'm a superstitious man," you know, that sort of thing. That it's written, but it's not said the way he would say it. And in the garden, he's an old man, and he's going to die of a heart attack. And he's trying to amuse his grandson. This is a little kid who was, you know, sort of not very experienced in movies and didn't know quite what to do, and they wanted to get him to laugh, so Marlon just grabbed an orange, and he made teeth out of the rind, and he tried to scare the kid a little bit, and the kid broke up. And that's the scene we remember. It's the child laughing, and then his grandfather falls down dead, and the kid is still laughing. It's a very eerie and very effective scene because of that. But he also he grabbed a cat when he was talking about how we're not, you know, we're not animals, we're just businessmen, and smelling a rose, and all those things gave so much more character to what essentially is basically is a thug. Don Corleone has come up the hard way and through a lot of deaths, but you're still rooting for him because Marlon gives him such character and warmth and familial feeling.
Well, there was a lot of criticism, I think, of Brando and his unwillingness to learn lines, even around the time of The Godfather. I think I've heard Robert Duvall say that Brando seems to be gazing around, and really he's looking for his lines that are pinned up around the room and things.
That's true. To some extent, he was lazy. I mean, as time went on, as I said, he was really mentally ill and had a lot of difficulty. After all, since both parents were boozers, alcoholics, and he was not. He took a drink now and then, but he was not a boozer. Food was his addiction, and he became bigger and bigger until it was almost impossible to hire him. And that business of looking for lines and essentially being lazy was the downside. The upside was, let me show you what it's like to be a live actor, not somebody who's reciting lines in the old classical tradition. Let me show you what it's like to live on screen. And yes, I'll be naked sometimes, and yes, I'll make a fool of myself sometimes, but when I move you, I'll really move you because I am that character. And you see that occasionally, certainly in the first five films, and things like Viva Zapata or The Men, and you see it later on in The Godfather, and you certainly see it in Last Tango in Paris as well.
Well, I think the most unusual performance of that early era then would be Julius Caesar, since he had to have the lines exactly right in that one, didn't he?
That's an excellent point, because everybody was putting him down at that point. You know, Frank Sinatra called him Mumbles because he couldn't stand the idea that nobody could understand him. And so Marlon, because Joe Mankiewicz wanted him, agreed to do an audition, but he would do a vocal audition. He sent a tape in of Mark Anthony's speeches, and it was so good that everybody began to suspect that Laurence Olivier had ghosted for him. It was not true. He had really studied the diction and worked on it, and he was so good in that film that John Gielgud, who is certainly a classical actor who reads lines, said to him, I'd like you to come to London and be in my repertory company. And as flattering as that was, Marlon turned him down because it would have meant theater, and theater meant 6 days a week and matinees and Sundays. He just didn't feel he could do it. But he certainly did it for that production.
We're talking with Stefan Kanfer, and his book is called Somebody, The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando. Was there ever any talk of Brando playing Hamlet?
Yes. As a matter of fact, strangely enough, a couple of people talked about that, including Olivier. They would have loved to see him do it, and I think he would have been a very interesting and challenging Hamlet. It was simply, and he knew Shakespeare too, but it was simply beyond his ambitions. I think Marlon never really charted a career for himself as such. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be Lord, you know, Olivier in an American term. I think he just made it up as he went along. He said about himself, I just jumped from one lily pad to another. And to some extent, that's true, because he was so good, he would always be hired, even if it was for a bad movie. And I must say, even in the bad movies, you'll see something, almost always. Say a movie like Mutiny on the Bounty, for example. There's a lot of awful stuff in there, but every now and then he'll turn around and give you a take, and you realize you're in the presence of greatness. And that happens continually with him. So, I think he would have made a good Hamlet, but it was not to be, and very inferior Hamlets like Mel Gibson's came along instead.
Do you think that Brando was an unintelligent person?
Oh, no, I think he was very bright. He had a great ear. Like a lot of people his age, and after he was born in 1924, they came up listening to radio. So he had a terrific ear, and all of those actors from that era had voices. I mean, everybody, when I was a kid, I would do, and all the kids from my generation would do Cagney, and we would do Jimmy Durante, and we would do Cary Grant and Humphrey Bogart. Nobody I know does Richard Gere. Nobody does Brad Pitt. Nobody does Tobey Maguire now. They don't have the voices with it. So Marlon had the vocal intelligence with that, and he was a great mimic. He was also somebody who could memorize a great deal if he wanted to. He knew a lot of poetry by heart, knew a lot of Shakespeare by heart, and he had a great gift for language, as you might expect. He could speak fluent, idiomatic French, and he did okay in German, too, but he never showed off with it. He just had those, and he was a voracious reader. He had a library full of philosophy and novels. He was a curious person, but I think largely untutored, so it was that kind of autodidactic kind of hunger that he had.
You would think that Brando and Charlie Chaplin would have been amazing together. What went wrong?
Well, Chaplin was at the very end of his creative life at that point, and when he made A Countess from Hong Kong, it was essentially a rewrite of a 30s movie, and Chaplin was smart enough to say, here's two hot actors, I'll get Sophia Loren and Marlon Brando together, and I'll make a terrific movie. Well, one of the reasons was that it wasn't a terrific movie was Marlon and Sophia Loren were oil and water. She couldn't stand him. There was no romance at all in there. She was trained a different way. He didn't like her very much. He tended to kind of bait his female stars frequently when there was no sexual attraction. And the Chaplin didn't quite know what to do about it. And what happened was something that he had written that was gossamer in the 30s turned out to be, you know, cobwebs in the 70s. It simply didn't work. And I think also Marlon couldn't stand the way Chaplin treated his son, tended to bully him. And it was just a psychodrama. Of course, Marlon saw himself in Sidney Chaplin and his father as Charlie Chaplin. So it didn't work at all.
Some of Brando's latter-day parts, I mean, he had this marvelous kind of renaissance when he did The Godfather and then the great Last Tango in Paris, which might have been the most raw performance ever done on film. How did Last Tango come about?
Well, Bertolucci liked the idea of Brando being in a movie with him, and he wanted to get to whatever the truth was in Brando's life. And he allowed Marlon a great leeway, and he had this little girl with him who was allegedly the romantic interest. I don't think she was very good in it, but, you know, she auditioned. They said, take your clothes off. She said, sure, just like that, bang, clothes went off. And so there was, she had no secrets, and Marlon did. But when they got on camera and he began to talk about himself, he was really talking about his life. He was talking about life on a farm, the humiliations of his father, the strangeness of this kind of rural upbringing, and this citified, yearning mother and the boy himself who was dislocated until he found himself as an actor. And all that worked. It was a very honest performance, so honest that Brando said, I've given too much of myself for this. I'm not going to do this ever again. And indeed didn't. I think that's sort of the end of what we know as Brando. And of course, he went on to do, you know, The Formula. And in some sense, you saw a little bit in Apocalypse Now. But then he began to recede into the shadows after that.
Yeah, let me ask you about some of those latter-day performances. Mm-hmm. Like Superman, that was an odd one.
Well, he played Jor-El in that, and it's obviously sort of a New Testament done in sci-fi, and he was paid a hell of a lot of money for about 3 or 4 days' work. But at the same time, if you look at that, you'd think there's no one else who could play that. There's no one else who could bring about that kind of authority on camera. It was not a bad performance. It's just something one wishes he didn't do, because you think he could have done more with that talent. On the other hand, he was then, you know, remember, he's 5'9". And he weighed close to 300 pounds when he died. He was probably, I think, between 250 and 275. So grotesque when he was playing those parts that they had to put a lot of costume on him and shoot him from a distance. I mean, he was in a phase in which he was quite self-destructive. They used to say about his great rival, Montgomery Clift, that his was the longest suicide in Hollywood, but I think Marlon's was longer. He lived to be 80, but it was just a slow, painful death, and coupled with the tragedies of his children, his daughter hanged herself in Tahiti, and before that his son shot the daughter's lover, and Marlon said, the messenger of misery has come to my house. So, you know, the last part of it is really, I'm when I did it, I was writing a tragedy. There's no way you could look away from this. So the last films are kind of echoes of what should have been a much more of a triumphant ending.
Yes. It's interesting now that Paul Newman has recently passed away, and we look at his career in retrospect and see, you know, how he continued working and, you know, maybe never had the impact of Brando, but I guess a career.
Yes. I think one of the secrets there, of course, is that Paul Newman, who was an extremely nice man, I knew him, we had a happy marriage, and a stable one, and I think that helped a great deal. And Marlon had never had no stability in his life. None of his marriages worked out. I don't think his relations with his children were all that wonderful either, because when he died, they put up all of his stuff, and I mean all, like driver's license and the Screen Actors Guild card and everything, up for grabs, and people came in and bought that sort of thing, and you would think they'd want some, reserve some of the letters or something. No, it was all up there. And so I think, you know, with Newman, you had that feeling, okay, you can have me as long as you want in Hollywood, but when the day the picture wraps, I'm back in Connecticut. And I think Marlon was entrapped for partly for just reasons of his own, partly because he's lazy, partly because they needed him and wanted him there. He was trapped out there in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills and sort of couldn't get away, except in Tahiti, and that didn't work out in the end either.
One of his odd and kind of forgotten latter-day roles was when he played George Lincoln Rockwell in The Roots, The Next Generation.
Yes, television. And won an Emmy for it, too.
And it's only about 15 minutes, but it's a pretty remarkable little performance.
It is. You know, there are people like Brando, and there are a number of them, Gene Hackman and others, who are liberal and love to play right-wingers, and love to, in this case, it's a Nazi he plays. And I think there was something so outside of Brando's own feeling that he really liked getting in the skin of a villain. He liked that to quite an extent. I mean, in Burn, Quimada, he did the same thing. He plays a kind of British imperialist with no feelings. And yeah, your observation is exactly correct. It's a short appearance overall, but you don't forget it. And that's the case in almost all of his films, even things like The Night of the Following Day, which is incoherent. But the same thing, you look at him, you say, hey, you know, who else could have played that? Who else could have done that?
That's a very odd movie.
Oh, it really doesn't make any sense at all. But and I won't give you on the air Marlon's opinion of it, but he certainly didn't care much for it and disavowed it. But he would disavow too many things that he did. And there's always, you always come away with something with Brando. You never lose in a Brando movie.
What about Reflections in a Golden Eye? That's an unusual one of his.
Now, it's John Huston playing around with Technicolor, but what is present in that, and Julie Harris said as much, is that, you know, Marlon could keep putting down what he did, but at the same time, you watch him. At one point, he's a suppressed homosexual in that movie, and he's putting on his makeup, and there's just little things he does in the mirror and all that. And she realized, this really is an artist. I mean, this is not a man trying to show off. This is somebody trying to get to the soul of the character, and that he could put it down as much as he wanted, but in the end, and he could deny that actors are artists. In the end, you were in the presence of somebody really quite great.
Somebody. The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando, and the author is Stefan Kanfer. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. Thanks for listening, everybody. From KUSP in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro. Bye-bye.